Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Sian Kane. The great David Sedaris once said, "A good short story would take me out of myself and then stuff me back in, outsized now and uneasy with the fit." Stephen King compared them to a kiss from a stranger in the dark, and Laurie Moore called them a love affair. A good short story can have all the impact, sometimes more than, a doorstopper novel. But what makes a short story work? How can some authors achieve so much in so few pages? Chris Power has been puzzling over this for years. For us, actually, on the Guardian website, where we have been running his brief survey of the short story series. There's a joke in the title, his pieces are never brief. Instead, they're hugely detailed and enthralling essays on the short story careers of different writers. Clarice Lispector, George Saunders, James Salter, and why their stories work, and sometimes don't. So Chris is a man well-versed in short stories, which makes his first foray into the form all the more daunting. We'll talk about our favourite stories with Claire and Chris later on, but first, a reading from the first story in his debut collection, Mothers.
Summer 1976. I've been thinking about my mother and the summer I lied about Nisa Hoffman. For 6 long weeks, the weather had been sweltering. You could be outside all day and never feel a breeze. I was turning 11 in September, but the hot days passed so slowly it felt like my birthday would never arrive. The birch tree on the lawn outside our apartment block stood still as a sentry. Not a branch moved. Its bark grew dusty, and its leaves hung like rags. During the day, when there was no one else around, it was like the world had stopped. In spring, Mum and I had moved from Stockholm to this new estate outside the city. Everything was spotless and uniform, right down to the birch on the lawn outside each building. Lots of people wanted to live there, but Mum's boyfriend Anders knew someone at the housing company. It was Anders who said we should leave our old place, because it was small and it was falling apart. He said this was the way to live, with room to move and green space around you. What only occurred to me later was that he didn't like the old apartment because Mum had lived there with my dad. And with me, but Dad had died a long time before, when I was too young to remember anything. He was fine, and then he got sick, and then he died, is how Mum explained it. Just like that, she said, clapping her hands together as if she was knocking flour from them. After we moved to the new place, away from my father's ghost, Anders tried calling me his little girl, but he didn't try for long.
Chris Power, welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. People may not have read your collection of short stories, Mothers, yet, but they may have read your writing about short stories because you are the author of our long-running series, A Brief History of the Short Story. So is it quite strange, having established yourself as somewhat of an authority of the short story, to then have to come forward and go, well, here's mine, here's my take?
I guess so, but I've always known I've wanted to write and I've always been writing, although I haven't been sort of public about it. So I guess I've always felt like a writer who also does journalism rather than a journalist who has now become a writer. And I suppose it always feels strange to me being called an authority on the short story, because the short story is so vast. It's like being an authority on literature. And it's kind of, I know you can have those and you do have those, but I feel like, yes, I've read a lot of short stories, but I'm still learning huge amounts. There are still so many writers that I haven't read or haven't read to a degree where I kind of know their work inside out. So yes, I've certainly been a student of the short story, and I think I am a student of the short story, but there's still a lot more to to explore and learn about it, I think.
And you said you've been writing this for a while. A lot of short story writers, when they talk about creating a collection, they say that a couple of the stories in there might be like 5 years old, and they've built a collection out of a greater body of work that's sort of been whittled down. Is that how it happened for you?
To an extent, I think it kind of happened in two phases, like about the oldest story in the book, albeit it's changed a lot since then, was written in 2010. And I wrote a couple of stories that year that were actually kind of something like the sort of platonic ideal of writing that I had in my head, like the writing I was trying to get to. I was writing for many years, just things that I just didn't think were any good. But once I had those stories, a few things got in the way, like, you know, having children, buying a house, this, that, the other. And so I kind of came back a few years after that, and there was a more concentrated burst of writing. I kind of made the proper time for it, which is so much of writing, I think, actually giving yourself the time to do it. And once that was happening, then I was starting to think of it, obviously, as a collection, like wanting to get towards that body that could be put together into a book.
You mentioned you had this idea of this platonic ideal of what a short story should look like, what it should read like. What was that ideal?
Well, not even what a short story should look like, because obviously that, you know, they can look like anything. I know some people say, oh, a short story has to have this structure, or this has to happen, or it has to have an epiphany, or whatever. That's all nonsense, really. If you look from, you know, Borges to Clarice Lispector to Joyce to Alice Munro, they're all doing completely different things, you know. But I think, no, the platonic ideal was more about, I don't know why I'm bringing Plato into it all the time, it sounds very grand, but it was more about what I wanted my writing to be like. So regardless of what I was writing, it was about, like, finding a voice, I suppose, is the simplest way to put it.
And the title is Mothers, and every time a mother came up in the story, my little ears picked up to sort of see if there was any deeper meaning in the presence of that character being there. But there's no real sense that this is themed around mothers. It's very much, a lot of it is about people hitting a dead end, whether it's in their relationship or in their job, or even a character like Eva, who is a character who comes up three times in the story from various perspectives, who consistently meets dead ends, and she's got some mental health problems, and there's very much the sense that she doesn't really know what she wants from life, but she's also not sure about how to fix that. Is that how it felt to you, in terms of that it wasn't necessarily something, when it came to naming your collection, that it wasn't necessarily a book about mothers, but there are some very important mothers here and there?
I guess that importance will kind of strike people in different ways. Like, it's been really interesting talking to people about it as it's sort of, you know, on the verge of being published, and as more people have read it, the sort of variety of response, and also the variety of favourite stories that people have, which is great, because I wanted it to be as strong as it could be throughout, rather than like, here's the hit, and here's my other stories. So it's been great that people have responded to different things. But it was when I sort of started reading all the stories as a collection, it actually became very apparent to me how many mothers there were in the stories. Like, the majority of the stories have mothers playing a fairly pivotal role, I think, whether it's implicit or explicit. I mean, certainly with Eva, she, in the first story, she's writing it from sort of decades later, but she's writing about her childhood. And the sort of quite intense, sort of quite mysterious relationship she has with her mother. She never feels like she really knows her mother. And I think that's something she carries through to the later stories. The first, middle and last stories in the collection are about her. And in the middle story, she's kind of lost and wandering. In the final story, she becomes a mother, which throws up its own problems as well. So it did seem to be something, not just in those stories, but elsewhere. There's a story called Run, where you only see a sort of glancing scene with the narrator's, or the protagonist's, girlfriend and her mother, but it's a very, it makes a big impression on him, I think.
It's quite a fraught relationship, isn't it?
It's quite a fraught relationship, which it is. I mean, I think when I read the stories as a whole, it did seem very apparent to me that a lot of them, at least, not that they were about motherhood, but they were, the mothers in them were both good influences and bad. And I think about how difficult it is to be a mother, and how difficult it can be to have a mother, for a whole host of reasons as well.
In talking about favourite stories, I think my favourite in the collection is The Crossing. It reminded me very much, there's a Flannery O'Connor story called The River, and without spoiling anything about the story, but there's a sharp moment of violence at the very end of the story. And I was wondering about how you balance a collection in terms of, you know, knowing where to put that story in amongst all these other stories, because it does stand out because of the sudden, how vivid the ending of it is, and it's a very abrupt ending. Knowing where to place a story within others, how did you judge that?
It was a lot of fun. It was kind of like making a mixtape, you know. And you're kind of like, wow, the outro of this song would blend perfectly with the intro to this one. It was something I spent quite a lot of time on, both on my own and with my agent, and then with my editor at Faber when they picked the book up. And we did talk a lot about that, because I think, you know, you read some collections. Mavis Gallant always had a comment I loved, I think, in the introduction to her collected stories, where she said, you know, that her stories weren't designed to be read through. You know, read a story, put it down, go and do something else, come and read another story later, sort of resisting that urge people have to. I mean, her collected stories was like 900 pages long, so I guess it kind of makes sense. You'd be sort of sick of it by the end of that. So she's protecting herself from that. But I think I did want Mothers to be something that, if you read it all the way through, certain, the stories sort of speak to each other in certain ways, or they, you know, the end of one might reflect on the beginning of another, and that you get something from that experience of reading it as a book rather than just individual stories, although obviously they should all be able to stand alone as well.
And there's also this element in The Crossing, and it was something I noticed in lots of the books, how often troubled some of your characters are when it comes to sex and their relationship with intimacy. And there's a story called The Colossus of Rhodes, and without ruining anything again, there's an element of sexual abuse in that story. And there is a line in there, I'm just going to read it because it's quite remarkable reading it, particularly now, where the male narrator says, "I've rarely spoken to anyone about what happened on Rhodes, but not so long ago, when I started thinking about this story, I described it to a lawyer I met at a party, and she laughed and said, 'And that happened to you once? That happens to girls hundreds of times. After a while, it's not even news.'" And it's very much news at the moment, and you must have written this story far long before Me Too, but is it quite strange? Has that paragraph or that story in particular leapt out to you with a new strange resonance because of what is happening now when it's published?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just talking to someone about that just the other day, because it was sort of, it was Me Too sort of, I had that conversation. That conversation I describe in the book is one I had, and it was, a couple of years before, it was sometime in 2015, and it really kind of, did open my eyes to this, just that her attitude that, oh, you know, this happens all the time. This is not, you know. And she wasn't sort of demeaning the experience that I had, that I fictionalize in the book, but it was just showing, a different perspective of that. And that's why I wanted to include it in the story, because I was actually talking to her about, I'm writing this story and I'm having sort of trouble finishing it. And then she, we had this great conversation, and that kind of supplied an ending, and actually supplied a way to put a whole other layer on the story. Just at the end of the story, it's sort of, the narrator sort of steps out of it and sort of commentates on what you've just read, because it seemed like such an important part of it, because it is all about, which again ties in with Me Too, it's about how does it affect an experience you have if you don't talk to someone about it? Like, does it sort of, for you, it can be very confusing, it can kind of invalidate its reality almost, you know. And Me Too has kind of shown that on a society-wide scale, all these people feeling incapable of talking about this because they either think they're going to be scorned for it, or they're going to be demeaned or ridiculed. And so they just sort of accept it and internalize it. And obviously that creates a lot of damage, which we're now thankfully seeing a positive response to.
In that story, the character begins to doubt himself about how he recalls the experience, and were his parents in the other room? Why weren't they there? Mm-hmm. You know, they must have been there. It would be strange for parents to leave a boy by himself. Did you feel any hesitancy about putting so much of what's obviously a very personal and possibly traumatizing experience into a story? Does it make you feel at all vulnerable to do that?
What I felt most awkward about was actually having to talk to my parents about
really?
It. After I'd, after I realised the book was going to be published, yeah. I was like, well, now I really have to talk to them about it. Because you kind of, you do question your memory, or it's, you know, by telling stories, that's how you kind of embed memories. And so if you never talk about it, then what it actually consisted of becomes quite hazy. In a similar way, doing what a lot of writers do, taking something from reality and then fictionalizing it to a greater degree than I do in that story, can also affect your memory of what actually happened. You know, if you go on a holiday with your partner and then you end up placing these two different characters in that situation who have a very different experience, it yeah. sort of bleeds strangely into your memory of that actual good holiday you had that's now replaced by this sort of psychodrama or whatever it is. So that story in particular looks at those questions of what is memory, how sort of fungible is it, and how does it work. And fiction is a great way of addressing truth by other means, I think, but it can also be a twisting path. Mm. You never know quite where it's leading.
There's a story in another story in this collection, Johnny Kingdom, about a man who has made a stand-up career doing a tribute act to another fictional comedian, Johnny Kingdom, and which I've recently watched the Jim Carrey documentary, which is Jim and Andy,
so good.
Which is an amazing documentary. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's on Netflix, about his time in character as Andy Kaufman, who was dead by that point. And it really rang true to that sort of blurring of where one person's professional achievements begin and another one's ends. But it's strangely, I mean, it's a story about a man who's very dissatisfied with his job and his relationship with this man that he clearly admired at one point. But it was also weirdly the most optimistic story I found in the whole collection, because a lot of the collection is quite sad.
Yes. Yeah, I think it is optimistic. It's almost got a happy ending.
Yeah, I finished it smiling.
good. I think, it leaves a lot of questions, because Andy, the character in the story, is, you know, he's someone who was writing his own material and starting his own career, and then it kind of dried up on him for whatever reason. He's got writer's block, but you don't really know how good he was. You know, he was getting a certain level of success, open mics and things like that, and getting booked at some comedy clubs and maybe opening for comics. But then he had to fall back on this sort of weird tribute act that other comics don't really quite understand, because it's not like in the music world you can sort of cover people's songs and stuff, but in comedy it's verboten to, you know, steal someone else's jokes or use someone else's jokes, even though he's being upfront about it. But I think what it really made me think about was that idea of when someone's creating their work, and where a lot of kind of maybe uncertainty or instability for artists comes from, is they have to believe it's good. I mean, to get anywhere with stuff, you have to work really, really hard at it, and you have to believe it's worth something, you know. And it's a subjective thing, but you look around and there's probably, you know, you look at 10 artworks in whatever media and you're probably not going to like a bunch of them. But the people who created them really believe in them. I don't think there are sort of cynical people who go, oh, this is crap, but I'll just pump it out there. and so, you know, you never really... I like leaving space for the reader to bring their own suppositions or thoughts to work. Like, I enjoy ambiguity in the art I consume very much, and it gives a sort of interactivity to it, if you like. Mm. And I think there is that element there for the reader to kind of try and figure out where Andy is with that. I mean, he does have actually a kind of epiphany. It's one of the sort of traditional epiphanies that are in the book, of how he can convert his terrible experience into potentially something positive.
Yeah.
Whether that will be good or not is without the bounds of the story, so we don't know.
And talking before about autobiographical elements in the book, I was wondering about that link between Andy sort of finding success telling the jokes of another man, but being very unsure about the quality of his own and whether, you know, whether he can stand on his own two feet. And and I was wondering whether there was any connection at all with your, whether you felt any vulnerability about writing for so long about short stories and then having to put your short stories out there and go, well, these are mine.
Oh, well, now I do. Now you mentioned it. You know, not really. I can understand that. But no, I see those two things as very separate in terms of my writing of them. Obviously, reading is very important to a writer, and everything I've read has fed into my writing in some way. But that includes, you know, it's not just short stories. That's the back of cereal packets, or it's, you know, Proust, or it's whatever, or a road sign. But there's no sort of map that's gonna tell you how to do it. It all feeds in and gets churned around by your subconscious, and then reemerges. But yeah, it is strange, sort of hearing people talk about the book and talking about, you know, the critic Chris Power. I don't think of myself as the critic Chris Power. Or I tend not to think of myself in the third person at all, hopefully, thankfully. But yeah, I guess there's an element of that. But I think if the writing's successful, then I think you're immersed in it and you're not really thinking about who wrote it or what their thoughts are. You're there with the characters and in the situations, and that's hopefully achieved by the writing, for some people at least.
And you're currently the critic Chris Power and the short story writer Chris Power, and you're going to be the novelist Chris Power.
I am.
How is that? Are you working on that? Yeah.
It going? I've started working on that. It's fine, thanks.
How is it comparing to writing short stories?
It's obviously different in the sense that your kind of period of uncertainty is much, much longer. I guess that's the largest challenge. Like, you might write a short story for years and years and years, but you probably know within a sort of month of working on it, if you put a few hours into it, whether it's kind of worth it, whether there's something there to work with. With a novel, you're kind of, that period is a lot longer. You're kind of working with it and going, is this going to work? Is this, you know, one wrong step, it could all fall apart. It's a house of cards, I guess, but I'm enjoying it right now.
Well, Chris is still with us, and Claire has joined us in the studio as well, because we're going to talk about short stories and the best of short stories. Claire, hello.
Hello.
Chris, there were some very bright figures earlier this year. There was a couple of places ran some stories about sales of short stories going up by 50% in 2017 compared to 2016. And immediately there was another call that we were in a renaissance of the short story. But you've written a piece for us, which should be published by the time that this podcast runs. But you say this renaissance has been called every 6 or so months.
I think I've called it several times in my career.
It's basically whenever a newspaper decides a renaissance has happened, the renaissance has happened.
Yeah.
Can you sort of talk a little bit about that and your feelings about it?
Yeah, my publicist should turn off the podcast right now. She'll be cursing me for saying that it's not a renaissance, the short story. But no, it is. It's definitely a perennial of the book's pages. And I think, I don't know if it's collective amnesia or no one just really, you know, cares that much.
It's marketing.
It's marketing. Yeah. It is marketing.
It is. It's actually people desperately want the short story to be a success.
Yes.
And if you can make a claim of renaissance, there's your story.
I think that's true. And on one level, of course, you know, if it's marketing and if it gets a bit of attention for collection X or Y, then great. But I do think it does lead to this sort of churn, so that if your short story collection is lucky enough to be reviewed, then often there'll be a sort of obligatory paragraph on the short story, capital letters, rather than talking about the work. And often short story writers get asked the same questions about what is a short story, is it coming back, when's it going to be as popular as a novel, when's everyone going to get paid 80 grand like F. Scott Fitzgerald did. And, you know, while it might be a short-term gain in that you get some headlines and the bookseller runs a piece, whatever it is, long-term it does damage the discussion of the short story, because the actual work gets discussed less and you talk about it as a genre in the same way that you don't necessarily talk about the novel. You know, you talk about the novel under review, but you don't always have to talk about, yes, there are death of the novel pieces, but they're a bit more spaced out and you don't have to address it every single time you're reviewing a novel.
You made a really interesting point in your piece about when you actually drill down into the figures, that this 50% increase in 2017 was largely due to Tom Hanks moonlighting with a rather bad collection of short stories.
Bad is far too positive. It was dismal. I got cross multiple times while reading it.
But with a very cute idea, the idea of Tom Hanks and being obsessed with typewriters.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think him and also Jojo Moyes, who's obviously a huge selling author. Yeah, they're 22%, I think, of that total figure. So astronomical. I mean, I think he must have sold close to 100,000 copies of Uncommon Type, I think. And I'm not sure Jojo Moyes' figures were, but you know, he sold out the Royal Festival Hall. That's something that neither Zadie Smith nor Don DeLillo did. That's like almost 3,000 people. And I think, yeah, it's sort of a freak wave. It's not like all the people who bought that book are going to then say, where's the next short story collection I can read and go out and devour it? They bought it because Tom Hanks wrote a book. You know,
in fact,
they're
probably more likely not to go and develop a taste for the short story on that basis.
It's not a great introduction.
Perhaps. And I guess that's what that froth does as well, because it sort of pumps everyone up or hypes things up. It's like, oh, the short story's here. And then everything sort of goes back to normal, and then it's sort of forgotten about again. So I think it sort of sets up something that never actually happens, and that sort of constant disappointment kind of gives it an inferiority complex as well. I think it's, you know, you just sort of accept it is a minority interest. I mean, the other element of it that I didn't have room to go into in the piece is the kind of thing you always hear from very reasonable people who just spout it, that it's, you know, our short attention spans. Oh, look, short attention spans, short story. It's a perfect fit. But, you know, a novel is designed to be picked up, put down, read a chapter, read it on a shoot, whatever. You're never going to sit and read a novel in 12 hours. So it's kind of built into it that you're going to read it episodically. Whereas a short story does tend to need to be read in one go. It takes maybe 30, 40 minutes to read maybe a 5,000 word short story. That's quite an awkward amount of time.
Even if you're sitting on the tube, you can't be jostled too much.
Can't be jostled too much. No, certainly not. But even just breaking it up can sort of, you might miss something, or, you know, that sort of intensity of it can be broken, and then you lose the thread and then it's all gone. So it's actually, I'd say, more time intensive, even though, yes, you can read a short story in a much shorter space of time than a novel. It actually demands, you know, these discrete chunks of time that don't necessarily fit into, certainly don't conform with the idea of a short attention span, I don't think.
Although, actually, in contradiction of that, Wendy Mitchell, who has just written this amazing memoir of living with dementia, who came on the podcast the other week, was saying that she's rediscovered the short story because she cannot remember a novel. Her memory isn't long enough to read novels anymore. But she can read short stories, and now she's getting to the poetry stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I was fascinated by that, because it was such an intelligent and resourceful response to a life situation.
Yes.
But also it talked about the dynamism of the short story and what it has that other forms don't have.
I mean, obviously I'm a lover of it, and I'm an advocate for it. It gives me a lot of things that I want from literature. It tends to be written in quite memorable language. It's sort of quite impactful. It's intense. But there are things that I know people don't like that sound fairly reasonable. The sort of cliched one you hear, my own wife adheres to, is, oh, it's, you know, you kind of invest in these characters, you get to know characters, you kind of get over the hump of reading something new and being in a new world, and then suddenly you're out of it again and you've got to start all over again, which sounds simplistic, but it's true. Yeah. I can understand that feeling. I don't share it, but I can sympathize with it. And I know that some people, you know, if they like the writing, if they like the world it puts them in, they want to be there for 12 hours. They don't want to be there for 14
Now, I've
minutes.
Always wondered, in terms of from the writing side, how much more labour-intensive it is. Because I know in journalism, Sean, you have this thing, actually, well, with things like blogging, for example, it's the idea that counts. Once you've got the idea, you can do the story. And you know, novelists will cast around for years for the idea of the novel. And that's one idea which will then carry them for 5 years or something. With a short story, you're having to have 10 new ideas or 15 new ideas for one slim volume.
That's true. Yes, I am brilliant, and all the ideas in my book are incredible. I know, I think it's, that's I'm being facetious, I should say. I think you hear writers saying different things. I mean, you hear, you know, a short story, there can't be a single word out of place. You hear much harder to write the novel. And I've heard, you know, very experienced novelists whose opinion their self-evaluation I trust will say, oh, I find it much harder writing short stories than I do novels. But I think all writing is so difficult. I think it's hard to say that one is more difficult than the other. I mean, some people, ideas flow out of them, but they can't necessarily find the right expression for it. Or some people will have one idea that sustains them over several books. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but they, you know, if the idea is strong enough, you can explore it in all sorts of different ways. I mean, John McGann, Irish writer who I loved, constantly returned to this figure of the son returning to the farmhouse and the mother and the father. And it becomes sort of archetypal, but it sort of grows in power the more he revisits it, I think, because it is a sort of fundamental situation. So
he occupied a place sort of halfway between a short story and a novel, didn't he? A bit like Alice Munro, can write very, very long short stories, which...
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Almost, they're sort of novels, aren't
they? Yeah, and McGann wrote good novels as well. I mean, he's one of those people who, you know, there aren't that many of them who kind of alternate between the two. I mean, Yi-Yun Lee nowadays does that brilliantly. I think she's alternated novel short story collection, novel short story collection with each of her books. But there do tend to be people who specialise. I mean, William Trevor published both, although he said that really his novels were just a lot of short stories kind of jammed together. But in a very lovely, self-deprecating way.
And someone like George Saunders as well, who's always been known for being very specialised in the short story. He's now written a novel and achieved great success with
and
that.
Finally got the big prize. I mean, that's the other thing. Prize. I mean, short stories are still locked out, aren't they, in some areas?
They are. I mean, yes, they're certainly locked out of the Booker, although Alice Munro did get on the Booker shortlist back in 78, I think, with The Beggar Maid, that was marketed as a novel, but it's clearly a collection of short stories. David Zaloy recently, you know, it's 50-50 whether that's a novel or short stories. And yeah, you could argue that maybe some prizes should be for both, like arguably the Goldsmiths Prize, that's sort of about innovation in, I mean, it says innovation in the novel, but it could be innovation in fiction. It wouldn't be so much of a stretch. But I know some people are kind of uncomfortable about judging them together. And the short story has its individual prize. I mean, there's the Sunday Times EFG Prize. That's for an individual story. The Edge Hill Prize is for a collection. Yeah, prizes do help, I think. And that's obviously somewhere that could grow.
Now, just bringing you back to where we started this discussion, which is about now and the non-Renaissance. And we have to mention Cat Person in this context, don't we? Because that's a real phenomenon. And there are people saying, oh, she's got... explain Cat Person.
Well, I actually got told off the other day on Twitter because I wrote a piece about it for G2, sort of explaining why it was a thing. And I described it as a story about an unfulfilling relationship between a young woman and an older man. And I got knocked on Twitter and you've clearly missed the subtext of, and I was like, well, that is kind of what it's about. And that's why it's resonated, because it's fallen in a particular time.
So it came out, it was the oldest tradition of all of short stories. It came out in The New Yorker, i.e. in a newspaper, magazine.
And they did hold it. They did sort of hold it and then very quickly publish it because of its new resonance, because of the Me Too and the Harvey Weinstein scandal. And it was a very deliberate act to publish it at that time. And of course it took off. And there's this debate about, did it take off because of the quality of the story, or did it take off because of the context in which it was published? I mean, you can't remove it from the context that it was published in. Part of the success is entirely due down to that and the other public conversations that we're having about consent and how women conduct themselves in relationships and power dynamics and that sort of thing. I mean, what did you think? Do you think it's actually intrinsically a good story?
I do think it's a good story. And I arrived to it sort of, I dutifully folded the page down in The New Yorker, as I do every week, and then didn't read it. So I've got a backlog of, you know, years worth of stories. And then suddenly, like, Twitter was just filled with, I'm like, why is everyone talking about cats? I mean, even more than normal people talking about cats on Twitter. And then I suddenly realized it was to do with this story. And so by the time I read it, it already had this level of scrutiny that a lot of stories wouldn't survive. I think it's a well-written story. And I think it's, yes, obviously its virality is because of Me Too, and it was because of what else was in the air. And because it paints this really interesting portrait, like particularly, I particularly remember the spoiler alert, she sort of sleeps with him because she just thinks, oh, it would be, I'd have to go through so many steps to actually get out of this situation now that I'm just going to do it. And obviously all those steps are there because of these, you know, encoded power dynamics. And she's sort of trapped by that. But she doesn't see it as being trapped. It's just the way it is. Mm. Like, this is what a girl like me does in this situation. So I thought it was fascinating to that regard.
She got a seven-figure deal. Now, that's a million, more than $1 million in the US.
Yes,
and then five figures in the UK as well.
Yeah.
But then you make the point it's not just for a short story
No,
collection.
So that was for the short story collection, which is written, and then for a novel, which I think she's underway with. So, yeah, they were both two-book deals. And, yeah, I think, obviously, yes, again, it's a freak wave, and any short story writers out there already spending their $1 million advances should perhaps not do that right now. But I think the point is, I mean, I'd be interested in seeing the split in those deals between the novel and the short story collection. Because even though the short story is the thing that garnered all the publicity, I'm sure they'll still be paying significantly more for the novel because that's where they think they're going to potentially recoup their money.
I mean, fiction writers in general don't get seven figures is never mentioned now, is it? It's always the mythical six-figure deal, isn't it, that everybody talks about. It just seems really extraordinary. But it's also the short story is a calling card. I wonder the extent to which you feel that is still an important role that it has to play in a writing career.
One of the things that maybe is true within the renaissance of the short story GABA is that it's becoming more accepted again, that tradition of launching a career with a short story collection, which has sort of remained fairly constant in America. Like, it's fairly common that a writer will publish a short story collection and then publish a novel. And that had not died away in the UK, but it was certainly encouraged every step along the way to maybe rethink your short story collection. Like, I remember having conversations with agents who were sort of, you know, interested in the writing, but interested if I was going to write a novel, and maybe weren't so interested in the short story. So that's a kind of element. It is an uphill struggle to get beyond. At the same time, look back at, not that I do look back at publishers' catalogues over the years, I've got other things to do. But if you did, you know, all the major publishers and the indies, you know, they have published a fairly consistent amount of short story collections over the last, you know, couple of decades, really. You might see shifts where sometimes the indies were publishing more and the mainstream publishers less, but still the sort of amount of collections coming out every year has remained fairly constant, which again sort of puts the lie to the Renaissance story.
So we'll be looking out for Christine Rupenian. Is that how you pronounce her name? Do you know?
Christine Rupenian. Might be Rupenian.
I think it's Rupenian, yeah.
Okay.
Next year.
All right.
Obviously, everybody's going to be looking out for what Christine does next. Whether she might embrace the dog, you never know.
But dog people.
but so in terms of existing now, happening short stories, short story collections, give us a few to start with. Regulars.
Well, I've kind of developed an Ottessa Moshfegh addiction over the last few months. Her collection, Homesick for Another World, has just come out in paperback, and it's an amazing collection. It got good reviews and stuff, but I feel like it kind of got lost, maybe because it came out so soon after her novel Eileen was shortlisted for the Booker. The stories in it were written over many years, have been published in the New Yorker and Paris Review and so on. But it's this amazingly bleak and very darkly funny worldview that she paints. There's a story called Dark and Winding Road, and just, if you're listening now, just go onto the Paris Review website and read the first 14 sentences of that. And then if that doesn't make you want to read the whole thing, just read them again and again until it does, because they're just brilliant. She's just got this rhythm to her prose. I know some people don't like it because, you know, there's a lot of skin disease in her stories. There's a lot of kind of like rotting corporeal matter. It's a pretty dark place to spend time. But my God, what a stylish she is. She's phenomenal. And Jenny Zhang, I don't know if you read her Sour Heart.
That was great.
Yeah, amazing. I think Lenny, which is Lena Dunham's imprint in the States, published it. And she has got this Dunham-esque, you know, if you're a fan of Girls, I think you'd really get something from it. She's sort of talking about Chinese and Taiwanese immigrants to New York in the 90s, but talking about all sorts of things like the politics of taking a dump when you live in a really small apartment because your family's really poor, and how upsetting that can be for everyone. And preteen sexuality, and it just, in this, she's got this incredible voice that you just want to spend time with and have it tell you things.
Those are all quite old-fashioned qualities you've been extolling. But then you've got people like Eley Williams, who...
Yes.
ATRIP, which has just been longlisted for...
Oh, the Republic of Consciousness Prize.
That's right, yeah. She's, again, but it's voice-led again. I mean, with her, you're really sort of plunged into this stream of consciousness that is just, it kind of reminds me a bit of Claire Louise Bennett's Pond in the sense that you always feel like you're with the same character throughout all the stories, although that's never sort of explicit, but it's this brilliant, creative, agile mind that's constantly doubting and undermining itself. So all the pieces are about these sort of, it might be someone wanting to kiss their girlfriend in an art gallery, or someone who's in the process of getting on or off a tube train, like takes these tiny moments and kind of goes down to a sort of subatomic level of them, and they keep on ramifying and ramifying. And it's just her use of language is amazing. You see her performing, I'm sure there's clips of it on YouTube or whatever, but if you get a chance to see her read, it's like performance poetry. You know, she's got this real sort of rhythm and charisma to her prose. You are sort of, you're plunged into this person's thoughts, and they're quite disordered.
Yeah, well, like that story you mentioned about kissing your girlfriend in front of a painting. The full title is Smote, or When I Find I Cannot Kiss You in Front of a Print of Bridget Riley. And it's basically one sentence, isn't it? From memory, it's one continued sentence that just leaves you feeling quite overwhelmed and breathless by the end of it.
Yes, not one for a short attention span.
Is there a possibility that in some ways that the short story acts as a laboratory?
Yeah, I think it can act as all sorts of things. I think you can have a very, you know, it just depends on the Catholicism of your taste, really, because you can read something very traditional that's sort of in a mould of Chekhov, and it can be fantastic. And you could read something like, Ellie Williams' work, or another writer, David Hayden, who I know that Justine Jordan reviewed for The Guardian and
really
loved, and that's
him.
A fantastic collection, Darker with the Lights On. And that is, the writing's quite enigmatic. There's a lot of figuring out to do. There's a lot of exploring to do. But that's part of its pleasure. It's whether you're game to take that dive with him.
That was Chris Power with Claire Armitstead in the studio too. His book Mothers is out now and published by Faber. Next week, we enter into award seasons again, so we'll be analysing and arguing over the long lists for both the Man Booker International and the Women's Prize for Fiction. Join us then. Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Sean Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.